This podcast is sponsored by ebookit.com, self-publishing solutions for the independent author and small press. Visit us today at ebookit.com.
Welcome to the Toastmasters podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin.
And I'm Ryan Levesque.
Ryan, we're going to new heights today, I understand.
Yes, we absolutely are. We have a fascinating guest today. Our guest is distinguished Toastmaster Sarah Safari. A few years ago, Sarah, who had never climbed a mountain before, set the audacious goal of climbing Mount Everest as a means to raise money for a charitable cause. On April 25th of 2015, Sarah was halfway up Khumbu Ice Falls, the riskiest part of the Mount Everest climb, as the 7.8 magnitude Nepal earthquake hit, triggering an avalanche on the mountain, ending Sarah's climb to the summit, killing nearly 10,000 people and injuring over 20,000 people. This truly is a fascinating story. Sarah Safari, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much, and thank you for giving me this opportunity.
I know that everyone's going to want to hear about your travels, but I have to ask you this. Your name. It's an incredible name. It's so adventurous. Tell us about it.
Well, this is such a normal name where I grew up. When I was born in Iran, and back in Iran, Safari is a normal last name. There are so many people with Safari last name. It means traveling. I always liked traveling, but not as much as I started traveling when I moved to the United States with U.S. passport. So when I moved here, everybody started telling me, Sarah Safari, did you change your last name? Or is your dad the owner of the Cologne Safari? I'm like, no, none of that. This is just a normal last name. And I love my last name, actually.
So my question isn't unusual then?
No. So normal.
Well, as Greg said, Sarah, we definitely are eager to get to the part of your story that involves Nepal and Mount Everest. But before we do, let's talk a little bit about your travels. You're coming here to the United States 13 years ago. What brought you to the U.S. and what did you start doing once you came over here?
13 years ago, my family and I, we moved to United States, and my hopes and my family's, my parents' hopes were like all four of us, me and my other three siblings, to go to better universities and study majors and continue on our education and just be more successful in life. So that was the whole goal of moving to the United States, and the whole family moved here. Since then, I've been studying electrical engineering at UCLA, and then I was working in different companies as an electrical engineer. And then I learned about Toastmasters, and Toastmasters made a huge impact in my communication skills and leadership skills that I thought, I'm so good in front of people talking, I'm going to start teaching now. Back then, I was so shy. And then after participating in Toastmasters, I started teaching. And now I'm teaching in a couple of universities, electrical engineering courses.
Well, Greg and I both picked up on something in your article. We were talking about it before we got you on the phone here. And that is, in the article, it says that when you moved to the U.S. as a young adult, you knew enough words to speak the language, but you struggled with listening. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? How was listening a challenge for you?
It was very challenging because the way I learned English was British accent. So it was hard for me to understand, and it was hard for me to use the words that I knew, because I realized people are using them a little bit differently compared to how I learned. The more focus when I was learning was on grammar. And when I came here, I thought that this is a different way of talking between people. Sometimes they don't follow the grammar, or there are slangs that I don't know. For example, first time somebody asked me, what's up? I looked up at the ceiling and I just said ceiling, and they laughed and they explained to me what's up means. I wasn't a confident person, so I didn't want to make mistakes. So even though I could sometimes understand people, I didn't want to talk back because I didn't want to make mistakes. It was hard at the beginning, but I guess Toastmasters helped me a lot to get over my fears.
Out of curiosity, what advice would you give someone? Like, what was there something in particular that you did to actively listen?
I want to say I was reading books or listening to a lot of music or watching movies. But what really made a huge difference, I like to say, was Toastmasters for me.
And how so? Tell us, because again, just to kind of restate what you said, you came here to the U.S. very shy, reserved, quiet, and now you're teaching at the university level. That's a pretty incredible change in not a lot of time. Can you tell us how the Toastmasters experience has helped you go all the way from who you were when you arrived to who you are today?
First, I remember the first meeting in Toastmaster. I showed up. I didn't want to talk. And it took me maybe like 5 meetings to actually start kind of participating in table topics. And a very first time for my icebreaker, I was shaking so bad. I was holding onto the podium. The podium was shaking. I blacked out. I couldn't think of any words. And I was just looking around, looking up at the ceiling, looking down. I couldn't even make an eye contact. So this is the first time I tried to talk in front of people. And my club, Irvine Lunchtime Toastmasters, now we are great friends. But back then, I just met them. They are such a supportive and a great environment for growing and improving and developing different skills, communication skills, and leadership skills. That for me, just being with them, we had meetings that only maybe 3 people participated, and then we had meetings 30 people participated. And all those times, there were people in the club, for example, Harry Yan. He's such a supportive person. He always asked me to go up, and he was mentoring me, helping me to improve, learn new words, using the new vocabularies, make eye contact. He would walk around in the back of the room so I can make eye contact by looking around. And the main thing that I think made a huge difference in Toastmasters for me was participating in the contest. Now I had to talk in front of people that I didn't know at all. And I wasn't familiar with them. I was thinking they might judge me, they might not, we don't know. But I rehearsed so many times and I practiced with Harry that when I was in front of people that I didn't know, I was talking the same way as talking in front of my club, in front of my friends. And something clicked in my brain that if you practice enough, then you have the capability to talk in front of people that you don't know the same way as people you know. I really felt that something new happened in my brain. Now I got the confidence and courage to talk in front of people. So participating in the contest was one of the best things I've ever done in Toastmasters.
That's good advice, especially since contest season is coming up.
That's right. A lot of very interesting background on you, but I think it's time for us to get into the crux of your story here. To lead us into that, I was thinking about this. I think if you were to kind of poll average people on the street and say, give me an example of what you think is the most quintessential impossible goal that someone could set for themselves, I think a large percentage of people would probably say, climb Mount Everest.
But then again, how many people would actually do it?
That's right. Yeah. So you not only came up with that as an impossible goal for yourself, but you set out to attempt to achieve it. So what were the circumstances by which you came up with this idea of climbing out Mount Everest as a means of raising money for a charitable cause?
The way it started, I was in the seminar called Landmark, and it's very inspiring. It's about personal communication, and it's just a great seminar. It's a 3-day seminar. On the last day, the third day of the seminar, the leader said, come up with a project that's so big and huge, beyond yourself, something impossible that you're sure you cannot do it. I'm sitting in my chair thinking, what is something beyond me, something impossible. somebody behind me started talking about, oh, have you heard Susie? She went to Everest Base Camp. And the moment I heard Everest, I thought, perfect. This is the most impossible thing. I hate cold weather. I've never climbed anything. I don't even have climbing gear. I never went camping before. It's just, this is the most impossible thing ever. And I said, I announced it in front of the class, the power of declaration. I announced it in front of the class, I'm climbing Everest. Everybody laughed, because if you look at me, I'm so girly. I'm the last person on the planet you would think she would climb Everest, because I don't look like a climber. And that's how it started.
Wow. And then how did you go about making that audacious goal that's easy to throw out there to the universe in a moment, but actually making that a reality of getting over to Nepal and climbing? What did that whole preparation process look like?
I went home that day and I Googled how to climb Everest, and the very first link showed up and I clicked on it. A phone number showed up. I called them and I said, I want to climb Everest. They said, have you climbed anything? I said, no. They said, how about Whitney? Like, Whitney is like 5 hours from us. It's the highest peak in U.S. continent, the North America continent, mm-hmm. and not including Alaska. And they said, have you even climbed that? I said, no, what is it? And so they kind of laughed and they said, okay, go climb Whitney and then call us back again. And that's what I did. I was so excited. It was in the middle of winter. I went and I climbed Whitney. It was like 5 feet of the snow in Whitney. I was alone in the mountain. And since I only trained to carry 30 pounds, I even didn't take a tent with me. So I show up there. I have to stay during the night. I put my sleeping bag and I put 2 bottles of frozen water in it to drink. One of them opens up. My sleeping bag is all wet. And I freaked out. I started crying because I thought, this is how people die in the mountain, wet sleeping bag, freezing cold. I took out my phone and I recorded my last video saying my last words.
And oh, my goodness.
And then I survived it. Somehow I just decided to jump up and down all night so that I can stay warm. And that's what I did. From that point, that night, I faced my 3 big fears. Fear of being alone, because I was the only person on the mountain, fear of dark, and fear of cold. I always thought when I'm cold enough, I just freeze and I die. And facing all 3 fears, my big fears, that night and surviving it gave me so much courage to continue on. So afterwards, I had training in Cascades in Washington State. Then I had training in climbing more mountains in Ecuador. And as I'm training, I'm climbing higher, bigger, more technical mountains. In Ecuador, the 3 mountains that I climbed, 18, 19, and 20,000 feet. Then I went to Argentina, and I climbed Aconcagua, 23,000 feet, which is the highest peak in southern and western hemisphere. And I'm the first Iranian woman who climbed that. Argentina is so far from Iran. Iranians don't go to Argentina, so it was easy to be the first Iranian woman. After Argentina, now I had the courage and I felt like I'm experienced enough to go to Himalayas. And I climbed Chuoyu. Chuoyu is the 6th highest mountain in the world. It's 27,000 feet. It's next to Everest. It's just 2,000 feet less than Everest. And it took us 45 days to climb it. Just going mountain by mountain, I had to stretch myself, put myself out of my comfort zone every single time. And little by little, I learned so much. Every single time, I learned that this is such a mental game. It seems like it's very physical because it's mountain climbing. But mentally, I had to keep myself motivated. Like, for example, for 30 days in a row in the mountain, living on an ice. Living on glacier. So tell myself every morning, get up, just continue on with headache, with sore throat. And you know, in high elevation, it's not comfortable because of the lack of oxygen. The body is suffering. It's like after some elevation, after 25,000 feet, body is like dying every second. The cells are deteriorating. And just keeping myself motivated and happy and pushing myself out of my comfort zone, the same thing that we do in Toastmasters, like pushing ourselves out of comfort zone. It's such an amazing training for me, both mentally and physically. And I'm so thankful that I did it, because I can bring all the lessons that I learned in the mountains and I apply it in my day-to-day life here. That's how, after QOU, I knew that I'm ready for Everest.
So how long was that time frame from the point that you said, I'm going to climb Mount Everest, that you made that bold statement, to the point where you were ready to get going, to the point where you were climbing?
2.5 years.
2.5 years.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that is absolutely incredible.
Thank you.
I understand that it takes about 2 months to climb Everest. Walk us through what happened on the morning of April 25th, 2015, and how far were you up the mountain?
Well, on April 25th, we left the base camp around 5 a.m., and it takes 6 to 8 hours to go to Camp 1. And the hardest part, the most difficult part of Everest to me was Khumbu Icefall, because it's so unstable. It's a moving glacier. There are seracs and hanging ice. Like, the size of the ice is huge, like a 3-floor building. And they are hanging on us, like they might fall any moment. They might melt any moment. So it's very unstable. And any moment, even without the earthquake, we try to hike it, climb it as fast as possible, because there are so many potentials to kind of die, and it's very risky. Around 12 p.m., we are on an ice wall. The past 10 days, we've been practicing crossing ladders. There are 50 ladders to go from base camp to Camp 1, and the ladders are different angles, horizontal, vertical, 45 degrees. Sometimes below the ladders, there is this deep crevasse, a 300 feet drop. We can't even see the bottom. And Nepali people say, if you fall into the crevasse, you fall into United States. This is how deep they are.
Wow.
And we are crossing all these ladders. We've been practicing for 10 days. The distance between the rungs is not the same, so the way I step on it every single time is different. And I have a very heavy backpack, so I'm trying to balance myself. So on the moment that the earthquake happened, I'm climbing an ice wall. This wall is almost 40 feet, 30-something feet, and there are 5 ladders connected to each other on the wall. That makes it easier to climb. Rather than just climbing it, we can climb the ladder. And then after the last ladder finishes, there is just a little bit more to climb, and then I get to the edge. So as soon as I finish the 5th ladder, I'm 30 feet away from the base of the glacier, that specific piece of ice. And then there are so many ice, hanging ice seracs over us, above us. And it's beautiful. The looking at the ice is just so beautiful. And I'm telling myself, take your time, go slow, save your energy. You need it when you go higher. And I finished the 5th ladder, and the whole wall started shaking left and right and left and right. And I thought the ladder is loose. The ladder is falling. I'm checking out the ladder. As I'm checking, a big piece of ice, like a 3-floor building on my left-hand side, falls down, and the noise it makes, like I'm standing on a runway and a commercial plane just took off. It was so scary that I forgot to analyze if this is an earthquake, if it is a ladder. I just didn't want to analyze. I just wanted to get to safety. So I started climbing really fast. I got to the edge, and there was an anchor there. So I started clipping myself to the anchor with carabiners, my everything, all the carabiners I have. And I thought, and then at this point, there are snow coming down. And I thought, this is the avalanche. I'm inside the avalanche. So the snow is coming down, so much debris, because there are so all the ice from all the ferrex and glaciers around are breaking down. So there is snow in the air, like a lot of puffy snow. And I couldn't breathe, so I covered my mouth because the snow was going into my nose and to my mouth. And I thought, this is the avalanche. It's coming down. It's going to push me, and I'm going to fall down 300 feet. Nobody could ever find me, and that's it. I thought, okay, I'm just going to wrap the rope around my hand, so when the avalanche is pushing me down the edge, I should be able to hold on to my weight, and I'm going to do this as best as I can because I don't want to fall down. And I was kicking my foot to the ice. I have crampons on and the two Francis spikes. I'm kicking my foot to make sure that my feet are now fixed. And I'm telling myself, breathe deeply. You need to keep some oxygen in. You're going to fall down. There's going to be a pile of snow on you. But since I have a transceiver, I knew they would come down. They find me. They might find my body. But there's going to be so much snow on me, I might suffocate. So I'm telling myself, breathe, breathe. But then I check my heart rate, it's like 200. And I really thought, well, this doesn't work. I just have to focus. And as soon as I try to focus and calm down, a big sadness hit me because I thought, oh my God, my family, this is such bad news. Then I felt kind of scared, and I was very sad, but at the same time, I felt this little amount of peace saying, at least I'm dying for a good cause. It's not just dying. As I'm thinking all this, everything stopped. And I was alive. So the rest of the team is down the ladder, and there are a couple of people above me. We all regrouped, and we had to continue on. The problem was the ladders from this point on, they moved, they were wobbly, they weren't stable. So we had to fix the ladders. And because of the avalanche, the trail was gone. And so we had to make a trail. So finally, we had just one more hour to go up, but we continued on for 3 hours. We got to the camp one. People are crying. Everybody is sad. And we hear the news about 20 people died in the base camp because of the avalanche of Pomori, and so many people died in the city and different places in Nepal. For 2 nights, we had to stay up there because helicopter couldn't come rescue us. The priority was with injured people and the bodies. 2 nights, we were in aftershocks and avalanches and aftershocks and avalanches. It was so scary sitting in the tent waiting for the next avalanche to hit us. Thankfully, none of them hit us. And then after 2 nights, helicopter came rescued us at 20,000 feet. And, you know, because of the lack of the air, it's so hard for the helicopter to land at 20,000 feet. It was like movies. The helicopter lands for like a second, and we have to jump into the helicopter. As soon as we got to the base camp, we could see the impact of the avalanche in the base camp and all the shattered and crashed everything, like tents and cameras and food and everything. And it was so sad because the base camp was such a happy place 2 days ago. Everybody is so happy. The season started. We are going up. And then it was like a graveyard. Everybody is so sad, crying. People's jackets are red now. They have blood on it because they were rescuing injured people. And 4 days we were there, and then finally we went down and got rescued again. And after 7 days, we went to Kathmandu. And as soon as we arrived in Kathmandu, we see the amount of the damage on the city. And the very first thing I wanted to do to go visit the girls of the charity organization that I climbed for.
You mentioned that if your life would have ended that day, you would have felt good in knowing you were doing this for a good cause, for a wonderful cause, for a worthwhile cause. Can you tell us about that?
When I was climbing in Ecuador, there was this incident that I was really scared, and I decided to stop climbing because I didn't want to risk my life. And as soon as I decided to forget about Everest, I met Dr. Jeffrey Cutler, who is the founder of the organization Empower Nepali Girls. 15 years ago, he goes to Nepal to do a research on maternity with one of his PhD students, and he realizes that some parts the girls disappear. Men who are HIV positive, they think if they be with a young girl, their HIV get treated, they get well. Girls become victims of human trafficking, or their family forced them to get married at a very young age. When I heard this story from Dr. Kotler, I was so moved that I wanted to do something for these girls. I decided to start training again to climb Everest, but this time is not for me sitting on 29,000 feet. This time would be to bring awareness and funds for the girls so that they can continue their education, have more opportunities in their future. So I promised the girls I'm going to raise $29,000 for every foot of Everest, $1 per foot. The cost for each girl to go to school one whole year is $150. So $29,000 would make a huge difference. And almost 200 girls could go to school next year. And that's how I kept motivating myself to continue climbing different mountains and continue training for Everest. So this organization, Empower Nepali Girls, is 100% volunteer-based. I've been climbing since I realized and I met the girls. They are so humble, kind, resilient, powerful, talented girls, and they deserve more opportunities. They never decided these kids to be born in a poor country, and they deserve so much opportunities. I decided to climbing mountains for them, specifically Everest, because everybody knows Everest and it's the highest, so I could raise the most amount of money for them.
Wow.
So, Sarah, you didn't make it to the top of Everest, obviously, but did you still end up raising the full $29,000?
Yes, I raised $50,000.
$50,000?
Yeah, just between my friends and family. Seems like I helped them, I helped the girls, but really they helped me, because go seeing them, how strong they are, how resilient they are, and how thankful they are for little things they have, really teaches me to be strong. And seeing the hardship that they go through keeps the problems that I have in my life, they look so small after seeing their problems. So it seems like I'm helping them, but they are helping me. So I'm always very thankful, and I feel so honored and privileged that I can do this for them.
And now, although you didn't get to the top of Everest back in 2015, your story, your journey tied into Nepal and Everest did not end there. And I know that because I was looking at your Facebook page for your Everest climb and saw that you were just in Nepal in January. So you can, could you tell us what brought you back to Nepal and what you've been doing since?
Since April 2015, I've been having a lot of fundraisers and a lot of talks in different places, for example, REI or Toastmaster Club, and different hiking organizations or foundations invite me to talk at their events, different banks, for example, Rotary Club. Just going there and talking and sharing my stories, people have been brought a lot of awareness to the cause, and at the same time, people were so generous, donating a lot of money, so we raised a lot more. So we had we go back every year to visit the girls and provide a scholarship for them and check up on them, check them, their schools, their families, make sure they're encouraged, they're continuing education, they're still at school, and their families and their school is empowering them to keep doing that. And then giving back all the money or all the stuffed animals or blankets and tents and lights that the people donated to us. We took everything back to Nepal, a lot of medications to help them build back and stand on their feet.
Well, Sarah, this has been one incredible journey just talking with you here today. I think Ryan will certainly agree to that.
Thank you.
Maybe you can perhaps let our listeners know how they can follow you on your journey.
On my Facebook, I try to update everything that I am doing for the girls or other causes. My Facebook is Climb Your Everest, and I have another page under my own name, Sarah Safari, so both works. I named my Facebook Climb Your Everest because everybody's Everest is different. Somebody's Everest could be a relationship, could be a master's degree, could be a new job, could be talking in front of people and doing the icebreaker speech. I love my page Climb Your Everest because, like, just looking at it, it keeps telling me that every day I can have a new Everest for me and go towards it and pick an impossible goal. And the best way people can contact me would be through my page Climb Your Everest, or they can email me at sarah@empowernepaligirls.org.
And what about for learning more about the foundation? Is there a specific page for that or site?
www.empowernepaligirls.org.
Okay, that's great. Sarah Safari, thank you so much for being on the Toastmasters podcast. We wish you all the best in all of your journeys and perhaps another Everest. Thanks for being on our show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
It's very inspiring.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Greg.
Isn't it about time you published that book you've been thinking about? We can help with that. At ebookit.com, we've been providing authors and small presses with ebook publishing services since 2010. Visit us today at ebookit.com and let us know how we can help you.